Look, I don't want to get too personal. I've never really asked a lot of revealing questions, and I feel like that's not a precedent I want to set. But Cargill, I have to know, how many paperweights have you ever bought in your life?
Maybe two.
And prior to that, were your papers just flying around willy-nilly in your office?
What was the
unhinged?
90s? You know, papers did that. It was the strangest thing.
Wind was so much stronger in the 90s.
Wind was so much stronger, and computers weren't quite where they are now, so you had shit on paper.
Hmm.
And so, you know, sometimes the air con would kick in, or someone would open a door, and there would be a draft, and you needed a goddamn paperweight.
And thank God the paperweight industry was as booming as it was.
It was. This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who were these guys?
Welcome to Junk Food Cinema. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film school rejects film cast that is so good it just has to be fattening, that is at least every bit as functional and important to your life as a paperweight. I think that should be on a t-shirt. We need to get t-shirts printed up that say Junk Food Cinema, at least as good as a paperweight. No? All right.
Except that our shows don't weigh anything.
Oh, very existential. I like it. What's the sound of one episode clapping? What's the sound of one person getting the clap? Don't answer that. We, of course, are Brian and Cargill. I'm Brian. He's Cargill. He's a lieutenant in Megaforce. I feel like I'm contractually obligated to mention at least that much. And by contractually, I mean I won't hear the end of it if I don't. So let's just get out of the way. How's that going, by the way? You a lot of words expended, or just deeds, or how's
it's going great. It's I'm Megaforcing along, and it's a wonderful, wonderful thing.
You turned a Megaforce into a verb.
I verbed a Megaforce.
You verbed a Megaforce. If you would like to hear us turn more things into verbs, you can always catch our archive shows on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, or like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And definitely keep sending us tweets and posting on Facebook. We've had a lot of great conversations with our listeners over the last few weeks about, you know, various movies that they have discovered through the show, or things they think we should cover in the future. We do listen to those suggestions.
Death threats for not having invited certain film critics to come in and talk about movies.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Apparently we have a couple of our mutual friends who work in the biz who are very upset with us for not letting them know, hey, we're covering this or we're covering that. And I'm sorry to those of you that have expressed outrage. We do record a lot of these.
We frankly didn't know you'd want to come and hang out with us.
We didn't think anybody would want to come and hang out with us, let alone, you know, listen to the show. But here we are over a year later and somehow still on the air. So thank you guys. We appreciate that.
And this week we have a movie with a cameo appearance by the patron saint of
Junk
Food Cinema.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Who delivers essentially the thesis of the movie.
Yep, that's what he does. That's his entire function in the film is to be the mystic on the journey. And of course, this week we are talking about the lost Martin Scorsese film. By lost, I don't mean it was actually lost. I mean that in all my time, it's very forgotten. It's totally forgotten. In all my time living in Austin, all of the various sundry geeks that I have met, that I am friends with, that I talk to ad nauseum about film, I never heard anyone mention this movie one time. I came across this movie a couple years ago completely by accident, and I started watching it, and this may be the premier movie of our August theme of the It Happened One Night, of the single night films. This is a very dark comedy that takes place over the course of a single evening in New York City. Because it's a Scorsese movie. I mean, one of the fucking cities are going to take place in Boston. That'd be well, that was good too, actually. But no, this takes place in New York City after hours. This is a film From 1985.
So now she's the one in the Mr. Softy ice cream truck who's trying to kill me. They're all trying to kill me. I mean, I just wanted to leave. You know, my apartment, maybe meet a nice girl. And now I've got to die for it, you know?
What do you want from me?
After hours, when anything can happen, and usually does.
Is that unbelievable or what?
So this would have been pre-Goodfellas. This would have been obviously post-Mean Streets.
Post-Raging Bull.
Post-Raging Bull. So definitely in prime Scorsese, but before I think he really became legendary Scorsese with Goodfellas, Casino, and the like. We don't see Scorsese do a lot of comedies. And after watching After Hours, I feel like you guys might agree with me that that's a real shame. Because even though After Hours is a very bleak movie in a lot of ways, it's really funny. It is absurdly funny. It is a fantastical farce. Like, this is a great movie that is unlike anything Scorsese has ever done before, and yet you will see the seeds of things that he would use to create some of his masterpieces just a few years later. But let's talk a little bit about the plot of After Hours. So After Hours stars Griffin Dunne, who you guys might remember from American Werewolf in London and the unfortunate fate that he suffered very early in that film. But Griffin Dunne is kind of amazing, and I feel terrible that I haven't seen him in more things, like that I haven't seen more of his stuff, because he's an exceptional actor. But basically he's working as, okay, now get this, he is a word processor. And I know a lot of you are thinking, so he's a program on your computer? No. Like, when they had to manually process words into computers, that is what Griffin Dunne does. And he...
The movie opens with the first of, like, a trillion D cameos.
Yeah.
Because what's going to happen here is, it being Scorsese making a New York film in the mid-80s, you're going to have this really amazing cast of people, some of whom are a long ways off from hitting their stardom. Like there was one in here that melted my brain. Like, I was prepared for almost all of them, and even one of them caught me off guard, and I was just like, are you fucking kidding me? But it opens up with Griffin Dunne and Bronson Pinchot.
Yep. So important to the 80s, that guy.
Learning how, you know, Griffin Dunne is teaching him how to process words.
Literally inputting one word at a time into a computer. It's mind-numbing. Like, they could easily change, like, modernize that to something, to some other type of monotonous job, but I can't imagine. I literally do not have the mental capacity to imagine a job more monotonous than literally entering in word by word.
That doesn't involve looking at your weenus.
That doesn't involve looking at my weenus. That's a great Friends reference. I like it. And so he lives this very ordinary life. And then one day he decides, he meets a girl at a restaurant, and they start to bond over their common interest in this author, Henry Miller.
And she approaches him. Like, yeah. He's just reading a book, and out of
nowhere. She has to talk to him twice, because the first time she says something to him, he doesn't think she's talking to him.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's not until she repeats herself that he realizes that she's talking. And so
this is Rosanna Arquette.
Yes.
In the mid-80s Rosanna Arquette, super hot, picking up this guy in a coffee shop. Mm-hmm. And this is where all the trouble starts.
And it's funny, too, because I feel like just from this moment, just from the beginning of the movie and the beginning of their relationship, I have to feel like it was at least a partial influence on Tarantino for True Romance, because something about the way these two start to connect and the conversations that they have together at the coffee shop, and like just these little very strange moments between two people who might never otherwise have met, just feels very True Romance to me.
It's an Arquette.
Yeah, there's definitely that connection. So he decides that they part ways, but he decides he's going to travel across town to meet up with her at her place. And this is where the Murphy's Law experiment begins. And I don't think in any other movie that we've talked about in this series does Murphy's Law really prove itself, where everything that could go wrong. In fact, everything that you couldn't possibly imagine would go wrong because you don't have any insight into that world goes wrong. And what happens is our hero ends up completely broke, completely, you know, to the point where things get so bad that at a certain point he is accused of serial robbery and a lynch mob is formed and is looking for him. And it is about as absurd a scenario as you could possibly imagine. And that's just traveling through it as we kind of see like New York by night. And that's the whole hook of the movie. And you know, as Cargill said, there's a lot of cameos in this. I mean, we've talked about how a lot of these movies try to create a roster of really colorful characters, of really sort of out there characters, and again, none of them more so than this one.
And a lot of these people at the time that this movie came out are huge stars.
Yes, exactly.
You know, you look at it now and it doesn't seem like it's a very star-studded film. It's familiar actors, but Terry Garr was still huge at this point. Mm-hmm. Cheech and Chong, of course, were at the height of their powers or just at the very tail end of their powers. And so many of the other people who just show up in this movie are doing very well at the time that this movie's made.
Yeah.
I'm pretty certain Rosanna Arquette had already done a couple of her bigger films by this point in her career.
Yeah.
And then of course, you know, several of the other people, especially even the smaller people, would go on to become bigger later, much like what we saw last week with Judgment Night. There are, you know, very small roles played by actors who would then go on to be like, holy shit, really? The one that really melted my brain that I keep referencing is when Will Patton shows up as a leather boy.
Yeah.
And he just shows up to deliver like one or two lines as a leather boy. And I'm like, holy fuck, that's Will Patton. And my wife's like, who? And I'm like, not quite
Robert Duvall.
Yeah. The not Bruce Willis, older guy in, Armageddon. She's like, oh, that guy with the sun and really having to be an astronaut. Yeah. He was in everything for a while there for like a 10-year stretch. It was get Will Patton.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, we talked about one of his a few months back.
Gone in 60 Seconds?
Yeah, Gone in 60 mm-hmm. Seconds. Mm-hmm. And here he is as this young leather boy in a Scorsese film in 85. And it's just like, the fuck are you doing here, Will Patton?
And that's truly the remarkable thing about After Hours is that every role, every character that our hero comes across on his journey is played by a superstar, you know, maybe not A-list celebrity, but like really great actors who, you know, every single person he encounters, whether it's Linda Fiorentino, oh, yeah, whether it's Terry Garr, whether it's Cheech and Chong, whether it's John Hurd, like John Hurd is one of those actors that I know, like, seriously, you guys, you've seen him in everything. I mean, he was the dad in Home Alone. He was the cop from the first couple seasons of The Sopranos that like Tony shakes down all the time. Just a tremendous, tremendous character actor. And every single character he encounters, down to a one, is that. And what I like so much about the humor of After Hours is that it is really dark. Like, he gets into some situations where you're like, you really feel bad for him. I mean, even though he sort of brings it on himself a little bit by, you know, like he's venturing downtown just to sleep with this woman. And then it's just the way that falls apart is so painful to watch, because you see him realize throughout the course of their, it's all really done through dialogue.
Yeah.
Throughout the course of their conversations, what an titanic mistake he has made coming all the way downtown to get laid by a woman who is clearly unhinged.
Yeah, she's out of her mind.
And living with a roommate who is making statues out of a paper mache that are just horrifying, and is this weirdo artist chick, and that's how he ends up crossing paths with leather boy Will Patton. But I will say this, you know, we talked about Dick Miller, who is, or I don't know if we've said specifically, but the patron saint of this show that we've mentioned is in this movie, Dick Miller. And he is the guy that, that says that, you know, the city is a different place at night. There are different people.
Yeah, they go in for coffees and how much do we owe you? And he's like, ah, forget about it.
There's different rules after hours.
There are different rules after hours.
Yeah.
Which is very true.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. It's, you know, it's one of the reasons I love being, you know, a late night person. I go to bed at about 7 a.m. every morning. And really, after the rest of the world's gone to bed, world gets a little kind of awesome and weird in like the best way. And interactions are just different and the rules are different. And so of course, New York City, it's even weirder because you have, you know, everything is walking distance essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And the city does stay functional late into the night. And so you can have these crazy adventures like what this guy goes on, with a whole different crowd that is of course all tied together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things about the late night crowds is that invariably when you're in a late night scene long enough, everybody knows everybody else. So of course this guy not belonging to this scene has no idea just how intimately tied in many of these characters he runs into are.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons I think John Hurt's character is so interesting is because John Hurt's character doesn't know Griffin Dunne from Adam and yet is willing to, first he's willing to give him money so he can get on the subway because he's like 50 cents short of the fare he needs for the subway because the fare goes up after midnight because after hours there are different rules. So he's willing to give him the money. When that fails, he gives him the keys to his own apartment and is like, if you go up by the key to the cash register, just bring it back. So even when Griffin Dunne is trying to be appreciative of the charity of the after hours crowd, like things just keep falling apart. But I want to go back for just a second to a scene we were mentioning with Linda Fiorentino making those statues. And we mentioned that Dick Miller's in the movie. I honestly believe that the statue she's making is a reference to Bucket of Blood because they are these really grisly, like it looks like people in the throes of death, and they make mention of the fact that it kind of looks like Edvard Munch's The Scream. And when you think about it, Dick Miller starred in Bucket of Blood, which was about an artist who wasn't taken seriously until he basically murdered people and then covered their bodies with paper mache, and people thought he was just being a really out there artist. And you also have to remember that both Dick Miller and Martin Scorsese studied under the same master, the deity of junk food cinema that is Roger Corman. So I really do think that the bizarre statue she's making is in fact a reference to Bucket of Blood, and I think it's a really sly one that really is a lot of fun to watch. But after hours, like the world that Scorsese creates, that post midnight other side of New York City is so over the top and fantastical, and the characters are so odd that it almost feels like if Lewis Carroll had tried to create a fantasy version of New York City, like, because the characters are also really enigmatic and they seem to be talking about things that on the surface you don't understand what they're saying, but they're really like investigating these really deep philosophical concepts. Like there's this conversation that Griffin Dunne has with the bouncer of a leather bar, like a punk leather bar. And it's
the Berlin.
And you're like, what the fuck are they talking about? And I looked into it. And it's like, apparently they're quoting Kafka back and forth to each other. So like, there's a lot of really like deep philosophical literary subtext to this. But because all the characters just kind of seem to be speaking their own languages, and they're picking up on they're picking up in the middle of conversations we didn't know we were having, it feels very much like a fantasy. It feels very much like we've stepped through the looking glass, and that's really intriguing, or at least I find it really intriguing.
Yeah, no, it's really fascinating. And the deeper he goes, the movie gets darker and darker until he's literally being hunted down in the streets.
Yeah,
because everybody's assumed that this new guy running around must be the burglar. yeah. who's been burgling all of them. And this is after he's witnessed a suicide and dealt with the troubled fallout of a suicide. And
yeah, he in one fell swoop goes from seeing a girl after she's killed herself to returning to the bar to basically, like, he's like, I have to leave this. He makes the signs that he makes. He calls the cops and says, I'd like to report a death. And then he realizes he has to get the keys back to the bartender. So he just makes signs for the cops that say dead body this way all throughout the hallway. It's just like the most absurd thing. And then when he gets back to the bar, bartender gets a call that his girlfriend has just committed suicide. And he realizes, like, as big of a city as New York is, he is in a very small part of it. Yeah. He is in this very small, like, you know, urban forest, this weird little wonderland that he's kind of stumbled into. And every decision he makes seems to be the wrong one. And it's not even a lot of things. There are a lot of things that are out of his control, but like when he pisses off Terry Garr, and then Terry Garr ends up being an artist who makes up all of these flyers that say he is the cat burglar, and like, yeah. just starts putting them up all over town. And he realizes that fate has really conspired against him, and he's running from a predominantly gay lynch mob through the streets of New York.
Led by an ice cream truck owning Catherine O'Hara.
Yes.
Also from Home Alone.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Home Alone connection.
So much Home Alone in this. And
after you admitted that you had a Home Alone 2 poster up.
I do. I did. Anyway, I don't know where it went. I'm very sad that I lost that. But yeah, and I think on top of, so what he's doing, he's taking this script, which, by the way, was written as a thesis for Columbia Film School by a very young screenwriter named Joseph Minion. That's where this movie came from. And he takes these, like, really, you know, it's very fantastical, has a lot of philosophical and literary references bouncing around. And then Scorsese does something where he's paying very odd tribute to Alfred Hitchcock, where he's kind of parodying the whole idea of the wrong man, you know, in the wrong place at the wrong time, and cribbing from Marnie at points, like using exact scenes from Marnie. And then on top of that, playing around with cinematography and these sort of long form shots and, you know, moving perspective, you know, kind of counter to each other, that he would use a lot in Goodfellas. Like, if you watch Goodfellas, there's a lot of scenes of, like, the camera tracking in very oddly and very kind of almost swimmingly onto a character from a very disorienting angle. And he plays with that in this movie. And it's funny to me that what started off as really just him kind of, you know, kind of just ribbing Hitchcock turned into a signature form for him.
And yeah, he even throws in a cameo here. He even shows up as a spotlight operator in Club Berlin.
Yeah. And that's the really great thing too, is that, like, I feel like you would never be able to accuse Martin Scorsese of being an outsider in terms of New York City and the streets. And I mean, he understands this world, and I feel like it's one of those, like, comfortable associations where he feels comfortable poking fun at it. Like, the way he pokes fun at punk culture in Club Berlin is literally, when Griffin Dunn comes in, they are forcibly trying to give him a mohawk. Like, they're trying to do some kind of weird indoctrination or something. And, you know, and he's up there on the catwalk, like, shining a spotlight. Like, it's called Club Berlin, and they're basically making fun of the fascist, you know, the state of Berlin at the time. And it's just, it's so bizarre the way he kind of shine a spotlight on these different subcultures while also poking fun at them. Like, the movie is dark in the things that happen, but it's also really funny.
Yeah. But one of the things I really, really enjoy about this is this, as convoluted and out of control as this story is, he literally could have stopped everything. Like, this is one of those stories that, unlike what happened in Adventures in Babysitting, when they get a flat tire, there's nothing they could have done about mm-hmm. that. and that literally they're just kind of grabbed and dragged through this. And then, you know, last week when we talked about Judgment Night, you know, these guys, you know, make a couple of bad choices, but from then on, you know, they get caught up in a situation having done some of the right things that just got them into trouble. Here, almost every bad thing he gets involved with is because he made a bad choice.
Yeah.
You know, had he not left the girl, had he not left Rosanna Arquette, she wouldn't commit suicide. Had, you know, she had he not dealt with Terry Garr the way he did, he would have never had the picture put up around of him. Had he allowed himself to get the mohawk at Berlin rather than fighting it and running out, nobody would have recognized him.
Yes.
Like, literally, he's offered all of these outs throughout the entire movie, and he always makes the wrong choice.
Yeah.
Which, as much as you feel for this guy, you're never really with him. Like, you kind of appreciate the scene more than you like him.
Yeah, no, that's very true. Instead of you're kind of sitting there hoping he doesn't get home, because the longer it takes him to get home, the more interesting and bizarre characters we're going to be introduced to. And yeah, he doesn't do a lot to help his case. He doesn't do a lot to really, you know, make you empathize with him. That's entirely true. Because again, it all started with him just trying to get laid and thinking he could do so pretty easily. And, you know, I know I have, and I can bet that most guys have a story or two in their repertoire about the things that they did thinking that it would lead to, like, the lengths that they went to for sex that ended up completely blowing up in their face.
I have no idea what you're talking
about.
You
are so full of shit.
I don't have any road trip stories. I don't have any crazy crosstown nights. I don't have any stories like that
at all.
I tell over beers and never on a podcast.
There you go. I was just noticing, by the way, that Joseph Mannion, the guy who wrote this screenplay as his thesis for film school, also wrote Vampire's Kiss, which makes so much sense to me because he is obviously a guy who believes with all his heart that as soon as the sun goes down, that the streets of every major city are flooded with weirdos.
So is he your favorite minion?
He may be my favorite minion of all of them. Yes, absolutely. Jesus Christ. Yeah. So I don't know. Why is it?
See, you're picturing him that way.
I am picturing it right now. I'm also oddly proud of the fact that this is the second show in a row you've made a terrible pun. I feel like it's infectious. What do you think is the reason that this movie didn't catch on with audiences the way other Scorsese? Because this is not like so early in Scorsese's career that people just didn't know who he was, weren't sure about him yet. Like, I can understand, for example, why people didn't latch on to a movie like Boxcar Bertha, even though that did moderately well in the drive-in circuit. Like, I can understand why people don't necessarily talk about Boxcar Bertha, because very early in his career, it's a very different film. I mean, I think we both really enjoy it, but it's out there. But this movie, I'm like, this is pretty much like right on his rise, and I feel like it just never gets brought up.
Well, yeah, because it came out in 1985. We're in the middle of the feel-good 80s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where cinema is cinema is, you know, it is still very geeky. It is right before, as we talked about last summer, you know, the big... in fact, a year ago in August, when we started talking about a bunch of our favorite sci-fi comedies, you know, it was right before the big drop off in '86, where, you know, everything kind of started to shift. Serious cinema wasn't being taken seriously by the mainstream. You know, it's a year after Ghostbusters, you know. This comes out with, you know, movies like Return of the Living Dead and Better Off Dead. And, you know, it's competing with comedies that are kind of laugh out loud and absurd and, you know, just ridiculous. And this is not a laugh out loud, absurd kind of movie. This is a darkly comic movie. This is not what was going on at the time. That's what makes it so interesting, is because it really was something going against the grain that just never found its audience in where it was. And so it doesn't have that nostalgia factor. And as good as it is not one of Scorsese's masterpieces, because he's made a couple of movies. He tends to make a movie every decade or so that is just a masterpiece. That is one of the best films of its era, you know, not just of its year, but of its era, where, you know, you can't talk about early 90s cinema without talking about Goodfellas.
Yeah.
You can't talk about early 80s cinema without talking about Raging Bull. You know, you're not going to be able to get away with talking about, you know, this decade without talking about Wolf of Wall Street, you know, and, you know, The Departed. You know, we make a Departed reference every 2 or 3 months.
We make so many references, it's Departed.
It's Departed. I'm not a cop.
I'm not a cop.
But so, you know, it's one of those things that does this even rate in his top 10?
See, and I don't know about that. But I feel like I'm a bit of a minority when it comes to Scorsese, because for me, his masterpiece of the 80s isn't Raging Bull. For me, his masterpiece of the 80s is The King of Comedy. That movie is...
another movie that did not connect.
And came out right before. That was literally the movie that came out before After Hours. I'm just sitting here thinking what it must have been like to watch something like Mean Streets and then Taxi Driver and think you have a bead on exactly what this filmmaker's about. And then he hits you with New York, New York, and The Last Waltz, and Raging Bull. And you're like, okay, Raging Bull, I kind of see it again. And then King of Comedy, and then After Hours, and then Color of Money. And you're just like, I can't get a handle on this guy. And, you know, and I think that's what's really interesting about this era of Scorsese is looking back at Scorsese, you know, retrospectively, you feel like there's a certain type of movie that is a Scorsese movie. But I feel like from, you know, all throughout the 80s, like, he was really, really fucking daring. Like, he was taking projects, like, for God's sake, he ends out the decade with The Last Temptation of Christ. That's how he ends the 80s. Comes in with Raging Bull and goes out with Last Temptation of Christ.
Like, and New York Stories.
And New York Stories. And just really, like, makes, like, that era of his filmmaking is so important, not only to his, you know, evolution as an artist, but I think to film itself. And King of Comedy and After Hours are two films that are comedies ostensibly, and on the, you know, there are things about them that are very comedic, but then there are things about them that are just so bleak that it makes you, it really kind of makes you teary a little bit.
I think the big problem is the fact that his epic films are so epic that people just tend to forget about some of the smaller stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, let's rattle off in order the films that are undeniable classics.
Okay.
Just the undeniable classics.
So just the undeniable Scorsese classics.
Mean Streets.
Yes.
Taxi Driver.
Yes.
Raging Bull.
Yep.
Then I would go up to Goodfellas.
Yep.
Maybe not Casino. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Casino, but I feel like Casino is almost kind of like a sequel to Goodfellas, and not in a good way.
Yeah.
It's almost like he's repeating himself, but I know a lot of people think that. So I'll put that up there as if you think Casino, I'm not going to argue with you on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, The Departed, maybe Shutter Island.
I don't know about that.
Again, I would put that up there. And then Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah.
Now, those are just his undeniable classics. Then you get into the ones where everybody has their own personal favorites, where, you know, there are people who are like, no, Bringing Out the Dead is one of his masterpieces. Or like you with King of Comedy.
I love King of Comedy.
Oh, yeah. A lot of people would argue on that.
Yeah.
The very fact that I didn't call Casino an absolute masterpiece, there are people out there that are going to want to kick my head in.
I mean, I actually agree with you. I feel like a lot of the things that are done well in Casino are done masterfully in Goodfellas, so I totally get
but
that.
My one that I love that is not loved by everyone is Cape Fear.
Cape Fear is really good.
I like his Cape Fear a lot. I know a lot of people feel it's terrible,
but
I like his Cape Fear a lot. I love The Last Temptation of Christ. And of course, you and I both really like Boxcar Bertha. We go back that far. But when you've got over half a dozen classics, like movies that will, like when you die, are going to be heralded amongst the greatest films ever made, you know, how do you, you know, how do you keep up with all this? Because there, he has made a number of movies that people forget that he made, like Kundun.
Yeah, I think it's okay to forget Kundun.
You know, yeah, but it, Kundun's not terrible. Personally, I love Gangs of New York. I think Gangs of New York is one of his.
I like most of Gangs of New York. I like most of that movie. It falls apart a little bit for me toward the end, but
The Aviator was a thing. That was something that exists.
Fair enough.
You know, it's the thing is he's such a great filmmaker and has made so many films and had such a long career spanning now 5 decades, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010. Yeah. So 5 decades of feature films, looking to headed towards 6.
Yeah.
Cause he's, I don't think that guy's ever going to fucking retire. I think he's going to be one of those who dies with an unfinished film.
He will die behind the camera, you know, and there's something almost like samurai about that. But I want to get back to, for a second, to the production of After Hours, because one of the things I found out that I found really fascinating is that when the project first came up, Scorsese wanted to do it. But then he couldn't do it because he was going to make Last Temptation of Christ. And the second choice for the director of After Hours was Tim Burton, because they had, like, the studio had just seen Vincent, which was a short that he did. And they were like, yeah, we want this guy to direct it. And then there were production delays on Last Temptation of Christ that made Scorsese available again. And Tim Burton apparently bowed out. Tim Burton was like, I'm not going to stand in the way of a Scorsese film, and bowed out, which, to my knowledge, is the last time Tim Burton was able to say no to something. So that's pretty great. I mean, that's a memorable moment.
That's actually true. I'm sure he says no a lot. I kind of want to, if ever there was a movie, I kind of want to build a sideways slipping machine and go into the alternate universe where that movie exists. I kind of want to see Tim Burton's version of After Hours.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be interesting.
Like, how weird would that be?
Super weird. Yeah. No, I can't even fathom it. Like, I mean, a lot of the dark and weird stuff, the sort of gothic playground of New York After Dark, like, I could totally see Burton wrangling that in. But yeah, no, it's a very interesting sort of, like, alternate universe where that was, you know, Tim Burton's first big movie, you know, After Hours. But yeah, I find this movie really interesting in that, like I said before, like, every time he meets a new character, it feels like they're already halfway through their own rough night. They're already halfway through their own adventure, and all the pieces don't necessarily come together, and you don't find out everything that's happened with every character. I do want to talk a little bit about the ending of this film, because the ending of the film is like him escaping the mob by being, like, basically plastered up into a statue and then loaded on the back of a van by Cheech and Chong as they're trying to steal the statue, and then ending up right back at work just in time to start a new shift, and going in completely covered in plaster, sitting down at his desk and just getting right back to work, but with a smile on his face. And I'm interested to know what your interpretation of that ending is, because I'm not sure, honestly.
Well, I've felt that that ending is, he survived. He made it through. He's back where he belongs. Like, he just had a crazy wild night and he feels alive. Like, that's one of the things, is that this is one of those movies that the undercurrent in the hands of a less capable filmmaker or screenwriter, they would have sold the idea straight up that this is a boring guy who doesn't have any adventure in his life and would just like to have a little adventure.
Yeah.
He just wants a little pussy. You know, that's it. Just a little bit, you know. So then he's offered the chance and, oh, this big life-changing adventure. And really what it is it's just... he's just wants to get home.
Yeah.
He just wants to go home. And then finally, by the end, he's really had this kind of amazing adventure and dealt with these really interesting people. Mm-hmm. And there's a number of great people that he met along the way, you know, from Tom, the bartender, to Pete, the, you know, the diner guy, to, you know, the interesting artist who he gave the massage to, you know, the really cool woman who always hangs out in Berlin that nobody ever notices. Cause
that's a really tender, really sweet moment in that film.
Yeah. And he's really, what he's looking for is a human connection. He finally finds it. Mm-hmm. And he's found that he's had it the entire night. And he gets through, and he gets through just by being who he is, not, you know, and it's interesting. And I think that's what The Smile's all about, is he's gotten through and he's had a hell of an adventure.
Yeah.
Like okay, that was a really cool fucking night. Like, when you're in it, it's not.
Yeah.
But that's the story I'm going to be telling for the next 30 years.
Yeah, no, I can totally see that. I do think there's a satisfaction in having survived that, for sure. I also think there's the smile could also indicate just this peaceful bliss of being back to something so mundane, because the way it bookends the movie is just really, I think it speaks to that, where it's like, after all of the shit I went through because I stepped one foot out of what I'm familiar with, I'm taking a little bit of, you know, respite in being right back where things are boring again, if only for a moment. And yet, you know, the juxtaposition of that is how crazy he looks now sitting there at work. He looks like he has been tainted by these crazy characters of the night, because he now looks like the crazy one at his office. I think it's funny that there was an idea. They actually filmed an ending and showed it to test audiences where the end of the movie is him just staying trapped in that statue, like he never gets out. And the audience completely rejected it.
Oh, yeah. That would be a terrible ending.
There were other ideas considered. One was it had this one. I don't even know what to say about this, but just try and go with me here, junkies. This made it all the way to storyboard, by the way. Paul, our hero, crawls inside of June, who is the woman from Berlin, inside of her womb, to hide from the angry mob, and then June gives birth to him on the West Side Highway. That was an actual storyboarded ending for this film. That I wouldn't.
That's the Tim Burton version. Like, that's what that is. Like, that is. I guarantee you, that's part of the Tim Burton development.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it could very well be. Could very well be. But I think the ending really works. I think I could understand people thinking it was a bit abrupt. But I think, yeah, I think again, at the end of such a Alice in Wonderland type journey that our hero goes on, off of one really terrible decision.
Followed by a number of terrible ones.
Followed by a number of smaller terrible decisions.
There are actually two other things I'd like to talk about that I find interesting about this movie, and this movie in context with a couple of the others we've talked about this month. First of all, this movie structurally is really weird.
Okay.
It's one of those movies that you never have any idea where it's going. It is properly structured in the way that it has three acts, and those acts have discernible changes. You never know what the movie's about or where it's going. Mm-hmm. Like, just at some point you figure out, okay, this is just a movie about a guy wandering around getting into trouble. Like, you never have that moment where you understand what this movie is, that it's going to be a guy just trying to get home.
Yeah.
Like, eventually you just kind of realize it, but there's no one moment where it's like, this is the story of a guy trying to get home from a bad night.
Yeah.
And so you just kind of go with it. And so it's really interesting in that way, where if you just sit somebody down to watch it, eventually they're going to be like, what the fuck is this movie about? Like, is anything ever going to happen? And it's like, stuff's been happening the whole time. Just watch.
Yeah. Don't believe me. Just watch.
The other interesting thing about this, and particularly Adventures in Babysitting, is both of these films come from the era of the 80s that fetishized the nostalgia of the 50s the way we fetishize the nostalgia of the 80s. So going back and watching these films, if you watch these two films back to back, and they make a great back to back watch, by the way. I just watched them last night and together as rewatches, and it was fantastic. And what happens is you can see, as you're looking back and fetishizing the 80s and going, oh, this, and I remember that, and they're dressed like this, and this is on the radio, and oh, they are doing the exact same thing to the 50s. There are dance numbers in both of these films that involve 50s music. You know, there's a lot of throwback to 50s style and 50s, like when you go through when we're in Terry Garr's apartment. And there's all these posters, all these pictures on the wall of people she's drawn. And most of them are people from celebrities from the 50s. Like she's living in that late 50s, early 60s, you know, and they have that whole joke about her being Miss Beehive 1965.
Not only that, but do you remember what record she wants to play for him?
I'm blanking right now.
It's the Monkees.
Yeah, yeah, the Monkees.
Which is a double reference because she was in the movie Head.
Yes.
So
written by?
Oh, John.
Jack Nicholson.
Jack Nicholson, that's
Jack
right.
Jack Nicholson wrote Head.
It's baffling to me that anyone would take credit for writing Head, but apparently Jack Nicholson does.
But yeah, it's so interesting to watch how these, you know, because it really is, you know, culture is a cycle. And it's going back and watching these fetishizing these films that we're watching that are fetishizing, you know, 30 years ago. And it would be interesting to then look at some of that art that they were looking at that was fetishizing the stuff from 30 years before that. So it's an interesting cycle, but it was something I found really interesting how and reminded me of so many films from this particular era, you know, the mid 80s where the 50s were, it was the 50s were cool, you know, drive a 57 Chevy and listen to 50s music and wearing the leather jackets again and the white t-shirt.
Oh, there's definitely a lot of leather in this movie.
Oh, yeah, but this is that's different. But yeah, it's something I found interesting about both of those films. Like, the 90s didn't have that concept, you know? It didn't totally fetishize the 60s the way the 80s fetishized the 50s.
Yeah.
So you don't see stuff like that in Judgment Night. Judgment Night is like, no, this is new, and it's edgy, and it's raw. And the mid-80s were not like that. And so it's just an interesting thing to notice when you're watching these.
And I was just thinking, too, about how Tim Burton may have also been a good fit for this project if you really think about it as a dark fairy tale and all the weird sort of mystical characters that you would kind of see in a fairy tale that turn up in their own iterations in this movie. But I think that all of these things kind of come together into a very unique experience. I mean, even though it's a film that's borrowing from Kafka, even though it's a film that's nodding to Hitchcock, even though it's a film that I think is making plenty of references to the collected lineage of all the people involved, it's a very unique experience. And by the end of it, like, you feel like you've kind of been through the ringer as well, because you this is a movie where you can't possibly know what to expect from one turn to another. And even when you meet characters that you think you have figured out, you can't predict the things that they're going to do. You were right there alongside Griffin Dunne as he is trying to figure out this Rubik's Cube of lunacy that is New York after midnight. And I don't know, I really enjoy going on that trip as well, right alongside Griffin Dunne. And I think that's kind of the magic of After Hours, and the reason why I wish it got talked about in the same breath as other Scorsese movies. But as we've talked about, there are the true classics, the undeniable classics, and then there are the sort of the B-sides. And I think it's a lot like music in that, you know,
this is one of his great B-sides by far.
Well, that's the thing with music is, like, everybody knows the hits, everybody loves the hits. There are songs that, you know, on the shoulders of those songs alone will probably get you into a Hall of Fame, but some people have a real emotional connection to those B-sides, and I feel like that's kind of me with this, the same way it is with King of Comedy. And I think that just makes the experience of being a fan of this filmmaker so much more enriching. So, yes, I would highly recommend After Hours, and I think it's the perfect note to end our It Happened One Night theme on.
What's the matter?
I said I want to see a plaster of Paris bagel and cream cheese paperweight. Now cough it up.
And that brings us, of course, to the junk food pairing, probably the easiest one I have ever done. It is a plaster of Paris bagel with cream cheese. Because the plaster...
You can't eat that.
You can't eat it. So just eat a regular bagel with cream cheese and think about the fact that somewhere, someone has or is currently selling paperweights that are plaster of Paris bagels with cream cheese. And much in the same way that a Playboy magazine became an unexpected plot point of our very first film of this theme, the plaster of Paris bagel with cream cheese became the impetus, the catalyst for one man's incredibly unfortunate evening that by the end of it, he felt like he was better for having gone through. And I feel like this movie is going to be a really weird ride for you, but at the end of it, you're going to feel like you got something very worthwhile out of that experience. So why not have a bagel with some cream cheese as you do so? It'll enhance the experience, or you just have a bagel, I guess. I don't know. I don't know what you want from me. Fuck off.
Late night diner burger, medium rare.
Or a late night diner burger, medium rare.
The rules are different.
The rules are different. We have two junk food pairings because the rules are different after hours. That's going to do it for this week's show and for our theme. Thank you so much for tuning in. We will be back next month with a brand new theme that we've already thought of, but we can't remember off the top of our heads, so...
We're literally running out of the themes. We literally, yeah. You know, we don't talk about this, but Brian and I got pretty hammered at a party one night,
yeah.
Over at my place, and just kind of brainstormed in the kitchen 6 months.
Yeah,
worth of,
yeah, that was a while ago.
It was a long while ago. 6 months, yeah. Worth of things, and we've gotten to that point where we're like, shit, what's next? We know we had something.
We wrote it down somewhere. We just got to find the receipt from Jim's that we wrote it on or something. But we will, and we will bring that to you as quickly as we can. Hope you've enjoyed. Please follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/ Junk Food Cinema. And we're on iTunes. We're on Stitcher. Cargill, where can people find you?
Well, you can find my new movie in cinemas right now. Sinister 2 opened last weekend.
Sinister 2?
Sinister. Sinister-er, as people like to refer to. Or as I, you know, as the we titled the original working script of it, Sinister 2, Electric Bagul.
Electric Bagul.
So we beat all of you motherfuckers to the punch. Done. Mic dropped. But please, that's playing in theaters now, so please check that out. You can also find me on Twitter at Massawyrm, MassaWyrm, or on Facebook.com, Facebook.com/Massawyrm.
All right. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also find me on Facebook, Facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic, or over at oneofus.net, my home away from home. There's a lot of great geek blogs and podcasts over there for every taste imaginable. And we hope you've enjoyed It Happened One Night. And we just want to remind you one more time that the rules are different after Junk Food Cinema.